I'm Faden Papa Michael, and I'm on the Cinematography Podcast.
The following podcast contains explicit language. You're listening to the Cinematography Podcast presented by Hot Rod Cameras, a program about the art, craft, and philosophy of the moving image and the people who make it happen. Coming to you from the world headquarters of Hot Rod Cameras in Hollywood, California, are your hosts, Ben Rock and Ilya Friedman.
Hey there, Ben Rock.
Hey. Hey, Ilya. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you. Our first show of 2025.
Oh my God. That means we've been doing this for 11 years now.
Yes, that's true. 11 years.
I mean, I think technically our first one was at NAB, so we're 4 months away from our 11-year anniversary.
But still, it's this year. It's been a journey. I was more than a decade younger, as were you back in 2014 when we started this show.
Yeah, neither one of us were gray old men.
Not like the gray old men we are now. Hey, yeah. Ben, who is on the show today?
Returning champion, Faden Papa Michael. I believe this is his fourth or fifth interview on here.
Yeah, definitely. I think his first time was the live show that we did at Hot Rod Cameras for Cinebeer many years ago.
I know.
Ago.
We got to bring that back.
Yeah, we'll make it happen. Maybe this year. I think it'd be a good time for it. June. We'll figure it out. So, Ben, I talked to Faden all about A Complete Unknown, the new Timothy Chalamet, a biopic of, oh my God,
Bob Dylan,
if I could get the words out. But yeah, no, it's a really great movie, and Faden's work is phenomenal.
I have to say, I haven't seen it yet because it came out wide during the holidays, and I knew that I wasn't going to be able to do the interview with him, so I didn't watch the screener. And I want to see it on the big screen, so I'm probably going to try and catch it this week.
I'm not a Bob Dylan fan.
Nor am I.
But I love the movie. The movie's great, and I got to say that I have newfound respect, I would say, I have newfound respect for the influence, because I was not necessarily alive when Bob Dylan's influence started to be really felt in the culture. But yeah. And I knew it was definitely a thing through the 80s in particular. My parents were fans, but I have newfound respect for just how influential Bob Dylan is upon, popular culture and music of many genres. It's impressive.
No, I'm looking forward to seeing it, and also I've heard that there's a Johnny Cash moment, and I'm like, since the same team, James Mangold and Faden Papa Michael, made Walk the Line, the Johnny Cash biopic, I'm just interested to see how that's handled.
It's handled really well, and I half expected to have a cameo of Joaquin Phoenix show up to play Johnny Cash, but no, it's not Joaquin Phoenix, but it's still really good.
A digitally de-aged 15 years Joaquin Phoenix.
Okay, so Ben, what do we have to chat about today? What is our close focus?
And now, close focus.
Well, it was actually so firstly, we should say we're kind of in the, as Charles Papert likes to call it, the taint of the year. It's
we're out of the taint,
but we're like one day out of the taint. So we've been dealing with like the Thanksgiving, Christmas, and New Year's of everything, which is like world shuts down, especially Hollywood shuts down. Everything gets super. I'm in the middle of like three projects, and if you need to get anything done here in the middle of this week, you're kind of screwed in the middle of the last month, I would say, because everyone's just checked out and people are slowly checking back in like 2 or 3 weeks, we'll feel like we're back in our lives again. So it's kind of a slow news thing, but you stumbled across this study that was on Variety. Maybe you can talk a little bit about it, but it's about viewing habits. It's about the attention economy, and it's pretty extensive and full of extraordinarily colorful pie charts and graphs and 3D charts, and it's very readable, and it breaks down our habits of what are we watching by many different demographic breakdowns, including by generation, which I thought was interesting. As you and I are both Gen Xers, it's kind of interesting to see like where we fall. Although, like in a lot of the charts, they make Gen X gray, and I'm like,
that's true. Yes.
Why'd you have to? It's like you're trying to erase us by making us as close to the same color as the background white as you can.
You know, I really appreciated this this Vision 2025 report, which you we'll put a link to it on the show notes over at camnora.com. And you may have already read this and noticed this, but do you know which demographic between Gen Z, Millennials, Gen X, and Boomers who uses social media the most?
I haven't seen that, so I get to make a guess here.
Sure.
And I'm going to guess. I'm going to go with Gen X. I think Gen X might use it the most.
You're 100% right. Gen X is the number one user of social media. Now, it's not night and day, but it's about 3% more than Millennials. And
I mean, we can claim Tom from MySpace as our own.
That's true. It's also interesting. They go into time spent with media. They go into different sorts of multitasking of people who do different sorts of
piracy. I was happy to see piracy. Like, we don't talk about piracy at all. And piracy was all I talked about in like 2010.
They talk about video games and multiplayer games and who's playing what, where, and when. And it's pretty fascinating the way that they break this stuff down. There's even a section on like immersive video and why.
I love it. Impacts immersive video, where they're talking about there's a chart of reasons for consumer disinterest in buying Vision Pro.
Exactly,
and the number one reason, to surprise of no one, is too expensive.
Yeah, and it's very interesting. They get into radio, all kinds of things, talking about, you know, the consumer experience of media. And if you are interested in sort of a statistical analysis of the market, and I don't know exactly how scientific or rigorous the variety study is, but I have to imagine that they probably put safeguards
with pie charts this slick. I'm guessing they at least are in the pocket of big pie chart.
Well, what I also thought was particularly interesting is that when you're talking about passion, people who describe themselves as passionate about something, far more people say that they are passionate about movies, television, and music than they are about social media, video games, and other things, which I'm
surprised about the video games in that. Like, yeah. Social media, I feel like, are you passionate about it, or is it just how you stay in touch with your friends?
Yeah.
Like, but I'm surprised people aren't more passionate about video games in this report, because, you know, to me, video games, especially given the slice of the attention economy that video games have very successfully gobbled up, as the father of a 6-year-old son, I can tell you how many video games that kid plays. Oh, dear Lord.
Yes. I think it's interesting, too, because like I certainly have kids who they spend a big chunk of time playing video games. So it's a thing. Anyway, Ben, let's get to the interview with Fade and Papa Michael.
Here we go.
The Cinematography Podcast Interview.
Hey, I'm joined now by Fade and Papa Michael. Fade, you've got a new movie called A Complete Unknown. Welcome back to the Cinematography Podcast.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. And yes, very excited about this new film. It was one of my true most inspiring films projects to work on.
It is a fantastic movie. I just saw it last night. It is very fresh in my mind. And I got to say, I really enjoyed it. The audience really enjoyed it. And we had a wonderful Q&A with James Mangold and afterwards. And we got to hear a little bit more of the sort of like backstory of this. He mentioned the movie started in earnest back in 2019. When did you come onto this project?
Well, you know, he had mentioned it to me at its original conception, and due to COVID and various other factors, and then we ended up slipping in is maybe not the right term, because it took a long, long time, but we did Indiana Jones prior to this, and luckily after that we were able to start pre-production on this. We had another false start because we prepped the year before in 23 in the summer and eventually started shooting in 24 in the early spring, which turned out to have a lot of benefits for us. And I'm glad that it ended up this way. Because we wanted, for one thing, we wanted a variety of seasons. The picture takes place, as you know, the beginnings of Bob moving from Minnesota, coming to New York, and we always sort of, to set the tone and the mood, wanted his arrival to be more in the winter, the tones, the palette to be more muted. So we were able to shoot before the trees blossomed and became green, especially because, you know, we found locations in Jersey. This picture was shot almost entirely on location in Jersey. And we recreated the village, West Village. But one thing I discovered during researching the period and looking at photographs of the time in the 60s, and there's lots of, you know, amazing photography from then, that there were actually no trees on the streets. You could see the brownstones, you could see the fire escapes, and then these trees were planted in the 80s, I think. You know, so we were, it really changed the mood of the location. And so it definitely helped trying to get the principal photography started before spring broke. And we were able to achieve the look that we were looking for in the initial part of the story.
It's really a wonderful look, and we'll dive into that in just a second here. But I was pretty blown away to find out that because of this big delay, that people who came on to the show early got all this extra. I mean, really got all this extra time, including like the cast. The cast, you know, Timothy Chalamet, Monica Barbaro. They both essentially get to go to boot camp to sort of like then impersonate, you know, these people from history, you know, Bob Dylan, Joan Baez, and they end up singing and playing like dozens and dozens of these songs. And it's not just a like cheap imitation. It's like they're channeling these people. It's really amazing. So what my question for you is like, when you've got this extra time, when you've got this you know, this ability to really sort of dive into what is, I think perhaps maybe you're grateful that this, you know, so many biopics, like they cover birth to death, they cover this huge span of time. This is like 4 or 5 years. That's it. It's 4 to 5 years in Bob Dylan's life. Did you really get to sort of like dive into different qualities about 1961 to 1965 and use that for what you created for the look?
Yeah, I mean, it was very helpful for every department, this sort of delay. I mean, first of all, you know, even though you're not technically prepping a movie, once you've read it and you sit on it, and a lot of my work sort of happens subconsciously anyway. I mean, I walk around, I think about things, I'm in New York or anywhere, you're processing, you get this extra opportunity to process like this image, you know, from the initial read and how you envision it. I mean, in this particular case, you know, there are a lot of reference photos. We, you know, with Francois, the production designer, he really put together these amazing lookbooks. We had still photographers from the 60s, you know, because a lot of the photos are in black and white, but also we had a lot of color photos. We discussed various looks with Jim, how we should approach it, maybe be a little rougher than our normal. You know, we've done a biopic, which is our seventh or sixth film, feature film together. So, you know, I was obviously asking the question if he desires to approach it slightly different. We came off a big franchise film that kind of like made us have to recreate a given look. And so we felt, you know, very liberated and back into our regular, what's more suited for us, you know, this storytelling of intimate character drama and similar to Walk the Line, where you have a personality that is, you know, in a way so inspiring. We didn't really want to lock ourselves into much, because when you're portraying an artist, I mean, part of what makes this interesting is like trying to tell the story where you figure out what makes this person tick. You know, what is, why did this 20-year-old, how was he able to conceive, and how did these words come to him? And he's a child, you know, so a very young man with very limited life experience. So, you know, to tell that journey and discover the world that he creates, because Bob is kind of known for inventing himself and reinventing himself. He did it throughout his career, not just in the time span that we cover. But, you know, he comes from Minnesota, from a Jewish family, and Bob apparently asked, I don't know if Jim told that story, but he goes, at some point when he was meeting with Bob, discussing the script, he goes, Bob apparently goes, so what is this movie about? And Jim goes, you know, Jim is very quick, and he goes, well, it's about this kid who kind of gets sick of his family and decides to leave them and moves to New York and creates a new family and then leaves them. And Bob goes, I like it. So, you know, but like, we all know what happened historically, but you know, this what struck me the most when I read the script, and you know, I'm very familiar, I grew up very much under the influence of Bob. I'm born in 62. I grew up in Munich, Germany. My friend was obsessed with Bob Dylan, always walking around the house with a harmonica rig and playing. So, you know, I know the songs, but really what I found the most interesting is how did he process all these impressions that he was getting by coming to the city, meeting Woody, getting initially by this folk scene, not being unsympathetic and to it, but also just wanting to be a rock and roller and want to have a band and want to have a drummer and an electric guitar and, you know, want to be on stage. And you know, he, you know, so the conflicts he goes through and not want to be labeled, which he never, ever wanted to do. What's interesting to me and inspiring as a cinematographer and how to capture something like this is, you know, what is the intimacy of the character? What is he, what are the little nuances that trigger him to be that person and to decide the steps that he's taking and the development of his life. And then Jim is amazing with it. And Timothy was, you know, is the main source of inspiration for this, because as you said, you know, he got some extra time. He became really amazing, not just in person, but like just creating a character that he absorbed, and his guitar work, his harmonica, and just the fact that he became more and more comfortable with it during the shoot, that, you know, he really wanted to play everything live, and it just adds so much extra something, you know. It's one thing, even if it's his voice pre-recorded and played back, but there's so many scenes where he's in his apartment, it's not just a concert and a performance stuff, it's stuff where he's, you know, sitting in his room and John Baez hands him this piece of paper, as you saw, and he goes, here, play this. And, you know, and they're playing Blown in the Wind for the first time. And then I love that scene. It's one of my favorite scenes. You know, she comes and joins in, and you can't really pre-record that. You have to let them perform. And Timmy is so amazing, and coming after a take and actually looking, which is something typically you don't want really as a director to watch playback. He would come over and we would watch him watch the take back and look at his reactions, and it's so beautiful, you know, how he's absorbing it and without insecurity, kind of like enjoying it. He would peek over at us and smile, or you know, laugh. It's something he did, and then he'd go, can I try one more? And it's so beautiful, because he would go out and always find like another little something, a little layer of something he added, and really always made it better. So it was very much this organic process of us capturing and him discovering the character, and you could just see it was so enjoyable for every crew member and every technician and every actor, for Barbara and Ed, like to watch him. Everybody was inspired by it, and they all did amazing jobs themselves, and everybody really wanting to, you know, it was fun coming to work every day. It was fun going home. I typically don't watch dailies, but I would go home and watch it just because it was so enjoyable to watch it back. So really special experience.
Yeah. I'm really glad that you and everyone involved got to have that experience. And it certainly comes through on the screen. It looks like everyone involved in this was having a phenomenal time. Thinking back about the movie, there's so much.
I mean, we really got to the point where we're like, how is Timmy going to handle this when this wraps? You know, it's like, because he just was Bob. And, you know, just like on Elvis, you know, it's like, I don't know, really, is he going to stay like that? He seems like he'll always be like this, you know?
So, well,
but I think he was able to snap out of it pretty quick. And, you know, he's an amazing professional and an incredible actor. But we were like, I don't know, I was thinking, like, how do you reach that point of absorption of the character and then just, like, you know, wrap and you go into your civilian clothing and, yeah, and you hug people goodbye and then you're back to being Timothy Chalamet.
Well, you know, I'm sure he would go back, because Bob Dylan is a complicated character, as
yes,
portrayed in this movie.
But so is Timmy.
Well, and thinking back about the movie, there's so much music in it. There's music from it more or less from beginning to end, but if it's not the opening shot, it's certainly in my mind the opening shot of Timothy in the back of this station wagon, and we're looking, like, you know, almost over his shoulder out the back window. He's hitchhiking. It's a wonderful sort of like way to get into the time and the era, because of course hitchhiking in 1961, really, really, you know, a common occurrence. And that sort of like introduction before we've ever heard him play, before we ever hear, you know, Timothy play as Bob Dylan, play any music, there's this sort of combination of tracking and following him sort of moving through the city. And there's, when he finally, you know, gets to his destination, there's all of these, like, well, I should say, maybe it's actually the second time he plays. He gets into this very, after he meets Woody, he goes into this dark club, this dark club, the first time that we see him play. There is so much sort of like down in the toe, down in the shadows of these, you know, sort of New York 1960s nightclub sort of scene. I love those sequences, and I love the look and the lighting of so much of this movie, where I feel like you said, something on exposure. We don't need on exposure. We need this soft directionality of club lighting, the soft directionality on the people, this, you know, high angle placement. Like, you create all these really dramatic shadows, and you can just sort of make out the audience and the crowd sort of through the dark. Yeah. Can you talk a little bit about, you know, because that contrasts very much compared to like the later scenes where he's performing, and, you know, he's performing in these big venues. Talk a little bit about the metamorphosis of, you know, the look of these scenes. And I love how they keep coming back too. I want to talk about another one in a minute, but tell me about the nightclubs. Tell me about that.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, as I mentioned earlier, we wanted to set the tone a little bit more in these muted tones, because, you know, he comes, he's like in drabs, he has his backpack and he's walking through the streets. He comes to McDougal Street, and we were lucky in terms of our weather, you know, it was all overcast and wintry. And then the clubs, you know, they're not, I mean, we have very beautiful reproductions of them. Some lovely photographs that were collected by the art department. But, you know, the lighting, I didn't want to do anything. I mean, I wanted to use the actual practicals, like what would be period correct. I mean, very simple, a little single park can spotlight. And I wasn't scared. I mean, Timothy has a great face, so does Barbara. Like, I didn't have to do, you know, Hollywood beauty lighting. I embraced sort of the mood and the sort of single source hitting him on stage. I mean, it was very primitive lighting, and we recreated that and embraced that, and also letting, like you said, letting the club ambience fall off. You can make out the people sitting in corners and little booths and maybe a little table candle. So that was very important for me to make that all feel very real. You know, I didn't want to stylize the picture with Jim. I mean, we discussed a rougher camera, but ultimately, you know, we keep rediscovering that we are traditional, maybe classic filmmakers, and that is just the language that we stick with. So in terms of composition and camera moves and shooting close-ups in an anamorphic aspect ratio, but with a wider lens close and creating this intimate close-up but still capturing the environment around him is something that has served us well, whether it's Ford versus Ferrari, creating the understanding of what it's like with Christian Bale to be in the race car, or whether it's Joaquin on stage. It's just something that we really understand to do. And we know that every film only is as strong as capturing the moments of your protagonist. So, but like, yeah, in terms of the mood and the clubs, really tried to keep that simple. Now, of course, as he develops and as he discovers himself and his, and as he becomes more colorful and more secure with accepting his popularity, also just through the wardrobe and the production design and the venues as they grow in size, you know, we go from a church concert to Carnegie Hall to, you know, the big concert scenes in Monterey and Newport, you know, the, and also we're entering a more lush and colorful period also in the 60s. Because the 60s really, as we think of them, really kind of started mid-60s. So like, it's like when people say 60s, it's really kind of 65, because the early 60s really were, belong more to the 50s, you know. So, you know, like the hippies, and you know, we have shots where he's walking down the village and the streets, and you got, you know, so many things are happening simultaneously. There's jazz and there's the hippies, and then and then there's Bob, you know. But it's almost like, it's not like we designed like a visual arc for it, but naturally happened because of the story and the different settings and his wardrobe and his hair and the Ray-Bans and his motorcycle, you know. So, you know, also in terms of photography, it becomes a little bit more expressionistic, a little more aggressive. The lighting, you know, the stage lights become a little bit bigger. The highlights are a bit hotter. The contrast, the no shadows are a bit extremer. The edge lights, you know, but it's all always very, I always approach lighting from, I never want anybody to perceive or feel that I'm lighting something. You know, it might appear stylized, but so do a lot of the actual photographs from the period. And I never want it to feel like there's a craftsman, you know. Like, I hate watching movies, and they can be gorgeous. I just watched this TV miniseries, and I'm like, it's incredibly beautiful, but I'm constantly aware that there's a very great craftsman's hand imprint on it. So I always like, you know, the photography to just allow us to focus on the story, focus on the character, and really not get in the way of it, and really not distract. I don't want to draw attention. But of course, this movie, I think, it's very beautiful. I mean, I'm very fortunate to have these settings, being the 60s, have Timothy, have Elle Fanning.
You've got
you know, it's like I have beautiful people in beautiful, cool outfits in one of the most photogenic cities in the world in a great period with picture cars. And again, Francois did an incredible job of actually recreating, you know, all the storefronts. We had like two blocks of period correct stores and signs and you know, very little CG work. It's a location picture, tight schedule. We had to move, do one company move a day. We probably had 100 locations over a 60-day shoot. And CG work is really just cleanup. Mm-hmm. You know, some things we couldn't control, non-period traffic lights or signs in the distant background, and then crowd shots. It's really not a CG movie. And very little stage work, only Bob's apartment, which was rebuilt and recreated very accurately to a lot of photographs of him in his apartment. And then a couple of motel rooms and hotel rooms. So, you know, very much a location approach to everything. And even when we're on stage, we treat it like a location. We never pull any wild walls, or we deal with the space limitations. And it's something that Jim and I really respect. And but yeah, the journey is great. Like, sort of as he becomes Bob, the famous Bob, you know, the visual language kind of follows, but it's not like we didn't really have to. I didn't really have to do anything in terms of lighting, you know, to emphasize that.
Well, you know, they say if you want to make a beautiful picture, it helps to start with a beautiful subject. And you've got, you know, this incredible canvas of which to work. But, you know, I know you're being a little bit modest, too, because, you know, you made Nebraska, which is, of course, gorgeous. And you can make just
very simple again, very simple, you know, very simple. I really love simplicity of a visual language. I really don't want an audience to become conscious of the craftsmanship.
And so do I. This is why I think your movies speak to me so much. But one of the things that in this movie in particular that I really appreciated are the subtle camera moves that happen at various points during the songs. There's like an important moment in the song. There's an important moment in the story, and there's a subtle push in. There's a subtle reveal. There's a slight shift, and they get a little bit more active and extreme as the music sort of changes in the later years too. But can you talk about making those choices?
Yeah.
When to push?
I mean, it's something it's something that very early on with Jim, we discovered our love for these. It's almost like our signature move, like this very almost imperceivable push in. I use a slider a lot, like a 4-foot slider, and it's all about the timing and the speed. And it's something, it's very hard to communicate like to a dolly group or something, because he goes, on what line should I start moving? And he does. And I go, no, you went too early. And he goes, no, but you said go on that. And I go, I know. He looked up from his lap, you know. Like, so it's something that, you know, Jim and I are very much in love with. And it becomes this dance of with the actor. You know, we don't really, I mean, we do make a shot list, but ultimately we bring the actors to set and they discover the space. It was lovely to watch Timothy sort of discover his apartment in every scene. Like, he would try out the armchair, then his bed, like pick up a guitar, like he would find the space and then we would kind of find the coverage. But, you know, we really embrace having, rather than just covering and changing a lens and going to a close-up, you know, it's like moving the actors, ideally walking into a close-up, turning, creating an over-the-shoulder. As that other person walks away, the over-the-shoulder, and the actors know it. They kind of know what you're doing. They like turn a little bit, I slide, and I just wrap around and reveal like one eye. And then he walks off and it becomes a master. And because we're on these wider anamorphic lenses, it becomes this dance, this choreography that's very beautiful. And that's something we're always looking for those opportunities. And in the concerts, again, I had this, my great collaborator, Scott Sakamoto, the Steadicam operator that I've worked multiple times. He was with us in Ford vs. Ferrari and I did Ides of March and Descendants. And again, on stage, you know, the connectivity between Timmy's close-up and Scott being able to just kind of find the moments, really pay attention to the performance and then wrap around, tie the audience in. We're never just these objective POV shots of the audience, or it always feels like you're on stage with the performers. We're using their energy and we always try to create a feeling what it's like to be Bob or be with Bob on stage. And we're physically very close. We're within like a foot and a half, 2 feet most of the time. And always trying to connect, you know, the people in the wings, the reactions, the audience. And we do that by little push-ins, little wraparounds, over shoulders that turn into three-quarter. You know, that's just something we're always aware of, to look for.
Yeah. There is a scene that takes place where Bob is in Joan Baez's hotel room. And I want to say it like middle of the night, gets out of her bed and starts writing music. It's such a beautifully lit scene. It feels to me like in that scene, Timothy's basically being lit by bounce light that's coming off of this messy desk in front of him. And he's got all this like cool color and uplight, and she's standing in a different sort of like a color of light pool in the background. And again, exactly as you described, there's this little move. There's like this little like slider move that kind of like comes over and reveals. And it's this wonderful sort of moment. Can you like, for me, I felt like it's a little bit of a turning point in that movie where we're really seeing who Bob is. Like, we've seen who Bob is, but this is sort of like, this is the turning point where he becomes Bob. And I don't know. I just, can you talk a little bit about that scene in particular? You know the scene I'm talking about?
Yeah, I mean, I love that scene because, like you said, he's in the foreground. You know, he comes to visit Dran, and then she's in bed. Obviously, he left the bed, and he just started writing. So it's a very simple shot. It's a wider framing and composition with him at the desk, and you feel her in the back of the bed, and then she wakes up at some point, and she turns on the light, and he just keeps writing, and she's... It's a great scene because she's realizing that he is very driven, and just the most important thing to him is writing his song in this moment. And of course, she gets a little bit upset because she feels like he's not neglecting her. But it's all told in this composition. And as she gets up, yeah, there's a little bit of shift, and we maintain sort of this over with him in the foreground and her in the background. She goes into the bathroom. She's in a different kind of lighting mood in the back. And he is lit by the bounce off the practical of a desk, and also a little bit of cooler light that comes in actually from the Chelsea hotel sign. But yeah, I love that shot because I love these shots that in a single composition kind of connect these characters and tell the story without having to be too cutty. And even when we cut around, you still see her. I don't know if you notice, there's like a mirror on the table and you see her in the reflection. And it's again, super simple coverage. And I mean, I'm always the happiest when, you know, you rehearse a scene like that and it's 5-6 pages and you go, you know, I really want to tell this beautifully and efficient and not get too cutty. Like, I just love, you know, I come from a European background, and Jim and I, you know, we're very similar. We the same generation, and he's a still photographer and his dad is a painter, and he loves Ozu and Wenders. You know, I grew up with the Wenders films, yeah, and Robbie Miller. And to me, those kind of storytellings are, you know, it's the most beautiful. And You know, so whenever we manage to achieve something like that, I feel very satisfied. When you just, and then it's nice because everybody recognizes it. Nobody's going like, you don't have a supervisor going like, yeah, are we gonna cut around and get a close up? And we're, you know, even she, Stella, our longtime collaborator, goes, no, this is beautiful. You know, like we don't need, you know, so this is always what you're looking for. And if you leave yourself open to making these discoveries and you're not locked into a storyboard and you're able to react to the performances, and especially when you have actors like that where you can hold on a shot, you know, that's everything. I mean, a lot of people are forced to cut because maybe the writing isn't so strong and the performances don't. But, you know, when you have people like that, and then you're just taking it in and enjoying it. I mean, that's the beauty of making movies like this. Yeah.
Yeah. I love simplicity, but I know that simplicity is not easy. So sometimes, you know, No.
Sometimes there's easy things. What you would think is easy is actually quite hard.
Yeah.
Because, you can't really do a lot of trickery. You got to kind of, it's got to work in that frame. So a lot of things got to be in harmony for it to be able to stand up in the editing room.
For sure. There's so many great, you know.
I did do something else that's maybe relevant.
Oh, okay.
I mean, I discovered, you know, this first time I shot on Venice 2, Sony, and it's because I discovered in early testing that I could rate it at 6,400, 12,800. Which is something I always wanted to do, is to shoot at a much deeper stop, because I was looking at some of my older films that I shot on 35 millimeter anamorphic, and I just felt like they didn't feel as shallow. Like if I just looked at the remaster of Million Dollar Hotel, the Wim Wenders movie, and it just felt that it didn't all blur in the background. So I talked to Jim about it. I said, you know, why don't we shoot all our night exteriors and interiors at a 8 stop, 11 stop, and we really embraced that. So I was rating the camera at like 12,800, probably that scene that we were just talking about. And it just, me, even on the street, night exteriors, walking, you know, it doesn't become just this large format digital frame. It really allows for you to feel the textures of the backgrounds, and also for me to really use minimal lighting. And that, in conjunction with what I did with a DI, which you know, ended up at Photocam and being a shift AI analog intermediate. So
I was going to ask about
regular.
Yeah,
we do the regular color correction in the regular DI process, of course, since it was shot digitally. But then after we optimize where everything will end up sitting on the negative, we laser out to with a film recorder to 52 or 3 Kodak stock. And so you actually, I have advantage of shooting at a very high ISO and with a digital camera, which I can't do on film. I mean, I can shoot 400 and push it a stop, but even these T-stock frames, they don't really have that much texture and grain. And then, so this process was really nice. So instead of emulating the way you would do with the live grain, you're actually going to a negative and then rescanning back in. And I found that this to be really the best, the most optimal way to take advantage of the technology that we have today and really create a film look that I feel. I don't know how you saw the film. Did you see it on a big screen? I really feel it has gone through film. So I think it's really impossible for anyone to say it was shot digitally.
I saw in the front row of the Zanuck Theater on the Fox lot, which is a fantastic, oh, wow. fantastic place to see it on the big screen. And I got to say, like, I had some knowledge going in that this was digital, but I at least on multiple occasions, I was going, this really looks like film. This really, really looks
yeah,
like
yeah. And that was the objective. We really tried to do that. And of course, you know, live grain and various techniques by adding grain and, you know, flicker. And I mean, you can change opacity. You can do many things. And the tools are great. And not everybody can go through this process that we did at Photocam. I got very fortunate working with David Cole after. But, you know, with having a lab in-house at Photocam and being able to do this, I was very fortunate that I could do this on this project.
Yeah, it's a great look. Let's talk a little bit about the color palette, though, too, because I know some of that is created in production design, but there is this enhancing of sort of, I want to say this, these browns and earth tones and whatnot, and a somewhat of a muting of more saturated colors, particularly at the beginning. I assume that this is a LUT, this is a grade, this is a thing. But was there a particular color you really wanted to play with? I have certain thoughts, but there's a lot of gray in this movie, and there's a lot of charcoals and the things like that. But it's it never feels bleak. Never does this movie feel bleak. It does.
Yeah, because gray. I maintain with the LUT, I maintain strong contrast. It's a LUT that I developed in pre-production when we tested the cameras, and some of the references I gave my colorist were obviously films from the 60s like Clute and French Connection, and you know, chips and it's definitely and I send them a lot of the reference photos, which back then, you know, they were mostly going away, but we found a really beautiful selection of Egglestones and color photos, which very much looked like Kodachrome. So that was what we were going for in the LUT. In terms of lighting, I really didn't use any color. Because back then, this is pre-color on stage and stuff. It's just white, you know, babies and spotlights and warm tungsten. I relied heavily on motivating and using practicals, you know, so I spent a lot of time with the set dressers and selecting practicals and then controlling them with Astera bulbs, various bulbs that we could control. But I lived very much in the tungsten, warmer tungsten world of, you know, 2400 Kelvin, but didn't really have to do much with color. Now, of course, later in the concerts, it feels more contrasty because maybe the sources are a bit stronger and the wardrobe is different, but we really didn't have to do much photographically to enhance that curve of development going from 60 to 65, because the whole world kind of changed and the way people looked, and so a lot of it comes from the wardrobe, the production design.
Was there much improvisation in this movie? It doesn't necessarily seem like it, but there was an offhanded comment about improvising some stuff during the Q&A that I saw last night. So I'm just curious, was there a lot of improvising in the movie?
It's typically, I would say no, but I mean,
because improvising as a cameraman, you know, it's that's always like, that's a challenge. You got to follow, you got to figure out, you got to like respond.
I mean, we definitely, when we're with Timmy alone in his apartment, you know, he can pretty much go and do what he wants, and we're the slave of the actor. So, you know, and everyone's on the tiptoes and ready for him to do anything. Yeah, I mean, there were some scenes that were kind of thrown together, especially when he's alone walking around and deciding to go to a window, go over, jump on the couch. So yes, I mean, we're always ready for that. We had that experience with that. We had that on Walk the Line. We never knew what Joaquin Phoenix is going to do exactly. You know, so was, and that's always our approach. And we don't really rehearse. We take one is always kind of the rehearsal. So, and very often take one gives you wonderful things, and we're ready to embrace it.
Hey, you know, Faden, I got a comment. Are you in Georgia right now? I know that you live there.
I am.
The room that you're in is incredible. Can you tell me, like, is this your home? Is this where
yeah,
where are
it's, you right it's now? My it is my office in my apartment in Georgia, which is from 1904, and this I think at some point was the Persian ambassador's office. But yeah, this is a home I live in Georgia, and was restored with all these frescoes and 5 meter ceilings. There's many more crazy rooms like this. But yeah, sorry, it's distracting.
It's awesome, and it's like I can't think of ever actually doing an interview where someone was in a room that looked like this before. It's phenomenal. So Faden, this has been a great conversation, and I think that this is you've been really generous with your time, and I know you've got more interviews lined up behind me. So hey, before we go though, is there a place that people can find you online? Are you on an Instagram or something like that? How can people of course they can go see your work, but if they want to connect with you, how do they do that?
I do have Instagram, my user, the name is Papa, P-A-P-A, 2. That's basically my only social media. I don't have Facebook and that kind of, but Instagram, I've been in from the beginning because my background was a still photographer, and I would take so many stills and have these slideshows, and people come over and nobody really cared to watch. And when Instagram go, oh wow, you know, there's actually a place I can show my photography, and actually some people like reacting to them. Of course, it's changed a lot since then, but yeah, I'm on Instagram, I'm Papa too, yeah.
Terrific. Well, Faden, thanks again so much for being on the show. If you didn't write down Faden's, Instagram name, don't worry. It'll be on the show notes over at the official website of the Cinematography Podcast, which is Cam Noir. Faden, thanks again. I can't wait to have you back and talk about whatever your next project is.
So that was Faden Papa Michael. Faden, thank you so much for being on the show again. Always great to connect. And
always a pleasure. One of the best.
Yeah, and if you haven't seen it, go see A Complete Unknown, now playing in theaters.
If for nothing else, see it for the Chalamet.
All right, Ben, you'll never guess what time it is right now.
Oh, it's the first. It's the first of 2025.
It is, but it is also time to pay the bills. We have to thank our fine friends over at Venus Optics. Venus Optics are, of course, makers of Laowa. Laowa is an incredible brand of lenses that are used for cinema. And just I want to draw a little bit of attention to a particularly awesome set of lenses that they have out right now, which is making some waves. It is the Ranger Full Frame Compact Zoom lenses. So it's a set of three lenses, the Ranger full frame cine zooms. And on the wide side, they start at 16 and they go all the way to 180. With these three lenses, you can do a tremendous amount of stuff. They're sharp. They have excellent color rendition and contrast. They are perfect for documentaries, music videos, commercials, or even a feature film. These zooms are bound to enhance your creative vision and elevate your shooting experience. There is even a Super 35 version, which is smaller and lighter. And because of that, they actually go wider. They start at 11 and then go to a 135. And of course, they're all on sale currently over at Hot Rod Cameras, where you can order these lenses. I highly, highly recommend, if you're in the market for sort of an affordable compact zoom lens, that you put this into your testing mix. The full frame versions start about $3,000. The Super 35 are even less expensive. And when you're talking about sort of this like really budget conscious, affordable, you know, small compact zoom lens, they pack a tremendous amount of performance for very low dollars. So reach out to Hot Rod Cameras, hotrodcameras.com. And if you're in the LA area or the Portland, Oregon area, and you would like to give them a test, reach out to us and we'll set something up.
Are you guys fully open in Portland now?
You're going to ask me that every week until the end of time. We're still by appointment. We're doing by appointment. Oh. I need to hire someone who can be here. You know, I'm traveling quite a bit. I do have someone else in the office, but they're not there all the time. So we are partially open. I did have a customer come in and make a purchase last week, just before the new year. So yes, we are open. But if you just like popped by it Thursday at 2 o'clock, there's no guarantee whether or not me or the one other person would be there. So we're working on it. It's going to be really soon. So, but regardless, this is a small market. This is in Portland. It's not exactly, I mean, I say this and it's raining outside right now. It's going to be raining probably for the next few months, but it's a, you know, there's plenty of sound stages. There's plenty of indoor locations that people are doing. And for people who want to shoot in the rain or looking for a rainy spot, there is a little bit of production going on.
For people who want the most miserable shooting outdoor experience, come to Portland at this time of year.
I'm not going to say it's miserable, but it's probably 50 degrees outside. So yeah, 50 and rainy. That's, you know, for LA natives, that's going to feel like a thing, which was me until, you know, 2 years ago.
And now, short ends.
Nice. Anyway, so Ben, it is our short end time of the show. It's where we talk about our pet obsessions. It could be our interests, our obsessions. What are you all about this week?
Well, it is a podcast, and it's one that I've mentioned on here before, but they just dropped a new season, or they, I guess, are about to drop a new season. It's You Must Remember This, which is Karina Longworth's amazing podcast where she kind of does deep dives on Hollywood history, and her new season is called The Old Man Is Still Alive. And okay, it's about all of the old timer directors, including like George Cukor and Alfred Hitchcock and Howard Hawks, John Ford, Vincent Minnelli, a bunch of those guys. And them, I feel like it's a preview because like history is cyclical and we're about to go through something very, we maybe are already going through this, where Hollywood reinvented itself in the 60s, and these guys who were making big movies, big studio movies like True Grit and My Fair Lady and stuff, were like almost overnight obsoleted by the people who are the old men of today: Spielberg, Lucas, Coppola, you know, and then, you know, the late Peter Bogdanovich, or the not late Henry Jaglom. She's already said that she's not really going to talk about Orson Welles, who kind of converted to being a professional weirdo sometime in the 60s. But it's these guys who were sort of the fixtures in the studio system who were struggling with relevance. Like the main picture of the season is John Ford by a pool in Bel Air, dressed in as an admiral, holding a pipe and looking at the photographer with withering contempt. I do feel like, you know, there's been a, I almost mentioned it at the top of the show, but like there's, for the last year or so, people have been saying alive till 25. And then our mutual friend and friend of the show, Bill Totolo, months ago said, well, I've been hearing shit and bricks till 26. And what I think we're experiencing right now is kind of a sea change in the voices that the culture is clinging to, that are reaching audiences. What kind of movies do we want to see? What kind, not just movies, but what do we, I mean, it goes right into our close focus about the attention economy. You know, I wonder sometimes, and I probably have wondered out loud on here, are we giving up our culture of films and filmmaking and even television so that we can watch a rando talk about their cat on TikTok? Or even worse, a rando talk about geopolitics on TikTok. Don't care what you think, sir or ma'am. Like, you know, everyone has an opinion. That's cool. But are we like spending so much time going down a streaming video rabbit hole? You know, and there are things, again, alluded to in that study about like vertical video. Like, I don't care about vertical video. It's either going to catch on or it isn't. And as it catches on, it'll either, if it does, it'll develop its own aesthetic and people will use vertical video in interesting ways that will surprise and delight us. And if it doesn't catch on, it'll be here for a few years and then we won't be doing it. But that's still talking about professionally produced stuff. And I feel like when I get on my high horse about that, do I sound like John Ford, you know, in, 1972 yelling about how, you know, Hollywood used to be this or that. So, on December 9th, Karina Longworth dropped the first episode and said that the next one would be out the following week. It hasn't been yet, so we're about a month out and we haven't gotten any new episodes, but I'm assuming that we're going to get a new episode here in the new year, and I can't wait to hear more.
Yeah, that's really fascinating. I will give it a listen because I think that we're actually in this really interesting period of time, and I think that there's a lot of people who don't really know what the next thing is going to be. There's a lot of theories. There's a lot of stuff. And it actually leads pretty perfectly right into what my short end is actually this week. So I got to watch, I didn't get to finish it, but I got to start Hundreds of Beavers. I know.
Oh my God. It's the best.
It was really great. And I had a couple of other commitments, so I'm going to go back to it. I'm going to finish it. But I was struck by something recently. I remember, the movie was released a year ago, basically last Christmas. So yeah.
We talked to the director and DP.
I know you did. And it's been in theaters now continuously an entire year. So it's been...
I didn't realize it was still in... I didn't know that you could see it in theaters.
Yes, it's still... It's been in theaters ever since December 27th, 2024. It's now, of course, January 2nd. And so that's been like 56 weeks. It's been.
I have yet to talk to anyone who saw that movie and didn't fall in love with it.
So
it's kind of a perfect movie for everyone. You know, they say you can't be everything to everyone, but Hundreds of Beavers is so great at what it is, and it's impossible not to like it.
So here's the other thing too. It was like $150,000 budget, sort of like all in, and it doesn't have an advertising campaign. It's switching from theaters and kind of moving around. It's been. The peak number of theaters it's ever been in was last April at 24. And it's sort of like ebbed and flowed, kind of come here and there. And I believe that some of this is going to be four-walling. I think the filmmakers might be like basically renting out theaters, putting it in there. And
we should ask them.
we should. I'd be really interested to know because the box office totals are being announced. And for a $150,000 movie, this movie is now definitely profitable from just their theatrical release. You want to take a guess at what they're at worldwide now from their theatrical? You want to play
idea, but
it's under a million, but it's still quite good.
Oh really? Yeah. I'll say, well then, I mean, 800,000. I don't know.
You're right. $771,000 worldwide. And what an incredible journey and story from like, you know, making this low budget movie, getting, you know, success and building an audience online, but then also that word of mouth going out to the masses and saying, I want to go see that in the theater. And then it being scheduled in theaters more or less continuously for the last, you know, more than a year. That to me is in some ways a little bit of an insight into what's happening potentially with independent cinema or, you know, self-distribution into the future. So,
well, I mean, so, you know, yeah. Much, much bigger movie than that, Terrifier 3,
perfect example,
which I think made like $60 million and had an advertising budget that was like $500,000. Although I would call Terrifiers 1 and 2 the advertising budget for Terrifier 3.
Terrifier 3,
even given that, like Terrifiers 1 and 2 budget-wise together are still under a million, I think.
Yes, I think there's going to be a lot more Terrifiers now after Terrifier 3. I think that's fair to say.
Yeah, but I also think there's going to be a lot of people trying to do what Terrifier does, and they're going to realize it ain't as easy as they think. But what's interesting about Hundreds of Beavers especially is that I look at that movie and I can't wait to see what those filmmakers can do with a bigger budget if they're allowed to be kind of let loose. Whereas like another movie that came out, I think more than a year ago, was Skinamarink. Mm-hmm. And it did pretty well. And it's pretty out there. I would be lying to say it was my favorite horror movie because it's like, it's almost a challenge to see if you can continue paying attention to it. And when I saw it, I'm like, I don't know that like these filmmakers, cause I went and looked at some of their YouTube people. I went and looked at some of their stuff and it was all kind of this very abstract art. It was like video art. And before you can say Matthew Barney and Cream Master 3, I'm like, I don't know that there's really a mass audience for this. But for Hundreds of Beavers, I don't know. Part of the charm of Hundreds of Beavers is how obviously cheap it is.
Yeah.
You know, like the beaver suits just look like what they are, which is beaver suits they bought on Amazon. Like mascot
like,
suits.
They look like a mascot. Yeah, they look like a mascot. Yeah.
It's like a live action cartoon. And I don't know that that kind of filmmaking benefits from being overly slick. Mm-hmm. I would almost rather see them continue to be self-contained and make, you know, kind of small, you know, personal. I don't know. I mean, it's like Hundreds of Beavers is obviously a personal film, but also something that has easy mass appeal. Like, immediately you're like, yeah, I can see why anyone would watch this movie. I was telling someone about it. They're like, is it violent? And I'm like a Warner cartoon. Like, it's not Hostel Part 2. You don't have to worry about, like, you're not going to need any therapy for having seen this movie. It's just fun.
Yeah. Yeah. I agree. 100%. All right. So Ben, I think that just about does it for this week. Where can people find you if they want to track you down?
You can find me at benrock.com. You can find me laying low with this cold that I obviously have right now. Thank you, travel. But yeah, go to benrock.com. You can find me on LinkedIn. A lot of people have been adding me on LinkedIn. And also Neptune Salad on Blue Sky. A lot of people have been interacting over there. And I'm still liking Blue Sky so far. So we'll see. And I haven't deleted my X account, but I only check it like once every week or so at this point. So.
Wow, you actually called it X. It used to be maybe Twitter.
I did call it X because it's my X.
This is your X because now you've moved on. Yeah.
Yeah. How about yourself, Ilya? Where can people find you?
As always, you can find me at the presenting sponsor of the cinematography podcast, Hot Rod Cameras.
I was about to help you there, old man.
I was about to say Cinepod, and then I was like, no, we're the cinematography podcast. And then I was like, yes, they know it's Cinepod, but anyway, I couldn't get the words out. Yes, you can find me at Hot Rod Cameras, hotrodcameras.com, and going to be in Los Angeles in a little over a week. So, cool. Yeah, I'll be down there, and we can meet up in person if you like.
Hopefully, I'll see you. I have a weird thing I'll tell you offline that's happening next week.
Awesome. All right. So, Ben, who do we have to thank? Who made this show possible?
As always, Alana Cody, who mercifully told us that we did not have to do this last week. Oh.
Yes. Sorry, everybody who was expecting a show last week. But, you know, it was the holidays and it was going to be a logistical hell to make the show happen.
I even offered to bring my rig to Ohio and she was like, you don't need to do it. But we got to thank her. We've got time. I have an interview I'm doing in about an hour and 15 minutes of a really exciting DP. So
I go tomorrow. Yeah.
Still cranking here. We got to thank Michael Dispenza, who is our indispensable editor. Do you see what I did? You know, someone was asking me about the thing about dad jokes and I'm like, I get them now. Now that I'm 6 years into it, and it's like, here's the thing about dad jokes. Dad jokes are revenge. That's all they are. They're meant to hurt.
Yes.
Yeah.
No argument.
Yes. Say that to any dad and they'll be like, yeah, I know exactly what you mean.
You let the secret out. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I said it to Alicia, my wife, and she was like, revenge against what? And I'm like, you just don't get it.
Yeah.
Anyway, and then last but never least, although there was a dad joke story in the middle there, yeah. Kays Alatrachi, who composed every scrap of music that you've heard on this podcast, check him out at Music by Kays, that's K-A-Y-S. Drop him a link. Hire him to compose your next score. He's awesome. He's one of my best friends. He's amazing.
Yeah. All right. So, Ben, I think that's just about going to do it this week. You want to take us out?
Why don't you take us out since I did the other stuff?
Thanks for tuning in.
All right.
This has been the Cinematography Podcast, presented by Hot Rod Cameras. Find your next camera, lens, or accessory on the web at hotrodcameras.com. Don't forget to subscribe to our show on iTunes and connect with us on Facebook and Twitter. Thanks for listening.